Okay, so good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Peng, for the invitation and the introduction. So today I'll be talking about some work that we've done recently on the possibility of pneumatic order in fractional quantum Hall systems. And so this work was done in collaboration with a number of people. So Shivaji Sandhi at Princeton, Steve Kivelson at Stanford, Nicolas Regnault did numerical work that will be that I'll be presenting today, and also Benjamin Hsu and Yijie Park contributed to earlier work on this. So we'll be talking about pneumatic order in quantum Hall systems, but I'll start by some general considerations about field theories of the quantum Hall effect that provided some of the initial motivation for this work. So we're interested in general in an old problem, which is the problem of constructing a field theory of the quantum Hall effect. And here, I'll be focused on abelian states, so the simplest quantum Hall states, fractional quantum Hall states, at filling fraction 1 over an odd integer. So if we look at the history of this problem, it's a very old problem. Some of the earlier approaches to constructing a field theory of the quantum Hall effect were done via what is known as the flux attachment procedure. So essentially, one considers the problem of interacting electrons in a magnetic field, and these are converted to bosons by introducing a gauge field known as the Trin-Simons gauge field. And these bosons see no net magnetic field, can then condense, form an incompressible state, and that state is the quantum Hall state. So this description is essentially a mean field description. One can improve upon the mean field by looking at small Gaussian fluctuations, and this describes a fair amount of the physics of the quantum Hall effect. So it describes the topological order in the quantum Hall effect. So if one goes from the flux attachment theory to a dual theory, then there is a topological Trin-Simons field theory that gives us ground state degeneracy on the torus, for example, also the charge and the statistics of the quasi-particle excitations, and also the quantized Hall connectivity, and also has in it the cone mode of the that was present also in the non-interacting problem, but certainly a part of the spectrum as well. One of the problems of this theory is that the bare electron mass appears in the energy of the quasi-particles. But we know that the energy of the quasi-particles should be really a property of the lowest lambda level and should not care about the energy scale of the cyclotron gap, which depends on the bare electron mass. And another problem with this theory is that so there is a collective mode, a neutral collective mode in the fractional quantum Hall state, in addition to the charged quasi-particles, which is known as the Girvan-McDonnell-Platzman mode, also known as the magneto-roton mode. This mode is not really described as a long wavelength mode in the theory. So it is constructed as essentially a bound state of many quasi-particles and quasi-holes. If we would like to have a theory of this mode as an explicit field in the Lagrangian, this theory does not give us that. So we will consider sort of a more conventional approach to this problem of constructing a field theory of the quantum Hall effect. And here, just as an aside, certainly the field theory of the quantum Hall effect in the topological limit is known, is the Trin-Simons Lagrangian. But here we're interested in going beyond that strict topological limit and having energy scales in the problem. So be able to compute gaps and energy scales and things like that. So in this case, we will, instead of using the flux attachment theory, we will consider a more conventional approach. And the idea is that in condensed matter systems, field theory arises in some kind of continuum limit. Okay, so in what cases can we take a continuum limit in condensed matter physics? So there is a continuum limit that can be called the naive continuum limit, where we simply take the limit of long length scales. And this works if the phase is generically gapless. So for example, if we have a broken symmetry state where we've broken a continuous symmetry, then we have generically gapless Goldstone modes, or more exotic fractionalized states, such as a gapless spin liquid, then all the physics essentially is at long wavelengths, and we can just take a continuum limit. There's a more subtle limit that we can take is if we consider a limit of a fixed ratio of a typical length x over a correlation length, and in a limit of a large correlation length, then we have a scaling limit. So essentially, if we're near a critical point, then we can take a continuum limit. So in the case of the quantum Hall effect, we do not have a generically gapless phase. So if we want to be near a point where there are gapless degrees of freedom, then it makes sense to try to search for a critical point in a quantum Hall state. So we will derive a field theory for the quantum Hall effect in the vicinity of a specific critical point. So there could be many critical points in principle. So you could imagine going from a quantum Hall state to a different state and deriving a field theory near that critical point. And in this talk, I will focus on a critical point for a transition between an isotropic, rotationally invariant quantum Hall state to a state that breaks rotation symmetry spontaneously, namely a pneumatic state. Okay, so that's sort of the approach here. So the starting point will be sort of a bare bones Lagrange that encodes the basic physics of the fractional quantum Hall state. So it looks similar to the flux attachment Lagrangian, but really it encodes some physics that is well understood and well known. So we will have a transcendence term that is responsible for the topological order. So in this case, the Q is in the denominator, but one can go to a dual picture where Q is in the numerator and we have a sort of standard transcendence theory for a compact H field. We have a field theta that will describe the quasiparticles. So a vortex of theta will be a Laughlin quasiparticle. Actually, in the second half of the talk, this physics will not really be very important, so we don't need to worry too much about that. And furthermore, there will be a parameter kappa. So this extra piece of the Lagrangian that is not topological, but this part of the Lagrangian will describe, for example, the cone mode in the theory, which is just a gapped mode that is there due to the magnetic field. And here, just as an aside, if we wanted to do flux attachment on a general Riemann surface, such as a torus, then there's a more rigorous way of doing that. But again, we won't really worry about that too much.
So this theory, how can one get a crack across the difference? Because naively, if I interrupt this smooth fluctuation C,
yes,
then you impose constraint.
That's right.
Then you solve the constraint by providing GMUS, like
the curl of some, yes. That's right.
Then you put it back, the theory looks like it's a 2x2 K matrix. Right.
Yes, so then, so if you integrate out this, the smooth part, this gives you, and then you can integrate out this non-compact field, because the 2x2 K matrix, I mean, one of the fields is compact, the other one is non-compact. So you should really integrate out this non-compact field.
Awesome.
Alpha here is non-compact. Yes.
So this alpha is the same as the alpha in transcendence action?
Well, this alpha is a non-compact field. And when I write JMU equals curl of A, for example, that A will be compact, but this one is not. You should really, you can integrate this alpha out without worrying about instantons or things like that. So that's why the usual transcendence theory that we're used to is the dual of that one, essentially. So in my language, if I write, Q over 4 pi epsilon A dA, so this will be, in my language, this is the dual of this theory here.
So this A will be the dual of each field from the vortex of theta.
Correct.
Dual to vortex.
That's right, exactly. That's correct.
Oh, I have to integrate out all the alpha.
Right? Yeah, that's right. So you would break up theta into theta vortex plus theta smooth, and then essentially, that's right. So you would, that's right. So then if you integrate out theta smooth, then this imposes the constraint that g mu equals zero. And then as Jin Cheng said, then you write g mu as 1 over 2 pi epsilon mu nu lambda d nu, let's say A lambda, so new gauge field. And then I have essentially the j mu alpha mu term. This becomes let's see. So we'll have essentially alpha mu d nu a nu, and then if I integrate out this guy, that's when I get this. That's right. And then what we had, so we had also the singular part, the vortex part, right? So that gives me 1 over 2 pi epsilon nu nu lambda d mu vortex times d, this is not nu, this is vortex. Let me call it vor. Right? And I can integrate out by parts, and then I could write this, you know, as J mu or J lambda, A lambda, J quasi particle, A lambda, where J quasi particle mu is basically 1 over 2 pi, no, epsilon d d theta. Right? Yeah. Yes?
So you're saying that the alpha in that term is not the same as that alpha in the first term?
So the alpha here?
Yes.
Yeah, so you know, these are the same alphas here?
They are.
They are the same. Is this that, so this extra, this field A that we're talking about here does not appear in this Lagrangian, but it would appear in a dual description.
Yeah. But then couldn't you just absorb theta into the definition of alpha? Because it looks just like a gauge transformation for an abelian gauge theory. So couldn't you just eliminate, just kind of absorb it, and then it's transparent to the first term, so it's not really a dynamical degree of freedom.
Yeah, that's a good question. So in a sense, you could do that for the smooth part, but the problem is this theta vortex here is not a single-valued function. So a derivative. So if you were to think of, you know, d mu of theta as a pure gauge, then we implicitly assume that theta is a single-valued function, a smooth function, when we perform gauge transformations. But this one is not, so that's why I have to keep it separate.
So you cannot take the derivative of that term there, of the theta sub v?
No. You cannot interpret it as a pure, it's not a pure gauge, really, because its curl actually is non-zero. Okay, because essentially, if you're trying to say, can I define some delta alpha mu, right? Which is, and you're trying to say, you know, can I redefine alpha? I guess we want to speak about alpha here. So can I absorb this by redefining, you know, alpha, something like that, right? Then, you know, if this is a pure gauge, then the curl of this would have to be zero, you know. But if you compute something like, you know, this, which is like a field strength, so essentially, you know, this actually is not zero if you have a vortex configuration.
Okay.
So it's not a pure gauge. So that's why I keep it separate.
I see.
Yes.
Thanks.
Sure. Okay. All right, so this is the Lagrangian that we have so far. So now let's talk about pneumatic order. So what is pneumatic order? So pneumatic order is the spontaneous breaking of rotation symmetry. So here I'm really talking about spatial rotation symmetry. And what is the order parameter for that order? If you're not familiar with pneumatics, you might think that, you know, the breaking of rotational symmetry is always described by a vector order parameter. However, if I think, for example, about a pneumatic liquid crystal, then which would consist, for example, of elongated molecules, then these are not like spins. These are headless vectors, such that the order parameter essentially is invariant under a rotation by 180 degrees of this molecule, for example, such that if I introduce a vector to describe the orientation of a molecule like this, the order parameter must be invariant under d goes to minus d, such that the simplest way to describe this is to introduce an order parameter that is quadratic in d, such that if d goes to minus d, this tensor here remains invariant. So this order parameter is called the nematic order parameter, and essentially it has two independent degrees of freedom. There's an amplitude, which describes the amplitude of the order, and there is a single angle, theta, which describes the orientation of this molecule. But because, again, because the order parameter is invariant under theta, phi goes to phi plus, or the angle goes to the angle plus pi, we typically define this angle to be phi over 2, such that if phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, we're describing the whole set of physical states, including this this redundancy. Okay. So if we write it in this form, then we see that this order parameter is symmetric, and furthermore, D being a unit vector, this order parameter is traceless. And so a traceless symmetric tensor in two dimensions has two independent degrees of freedom. So this is the physics of nematicity. How does this connect to the quantum Hall state? Well, it turns out from a number of earlier studies that, so at the beginning of the talk, I mentioned this Girvin-McDonald-Platzman mode, which is a collective mode in the quantum Hall effect. Actually, this mode has a symmetry of a quadrupole. There's different ways to see that. There's some early work by Li and Zhang showing that you could interpret the GMP mode as a bound state of two quasi-holes and two quasi-particles that is overall neutral, but that essentially forms a quadrupole. So essentially two positive charges and two negative charges arranged such that there's no net total charge and no net total dipole moment. And furthermore, there is more recent numerical work showing that at long wavelengths, this mode, so for example, from numerical studies on the sphere, one can show that this mode has angular momentum L equal 2. So essentially is a quadrupolar mode. So for our purposes, we will identify this GMP mode with the fluctuations of this nematic order parameter, because in fact, a nematic order parameter and a quadrupole have exactly the same. You could think of QAB as a quadrupole tensor in sort of the multiple expansion of a potential in electrodynamics. Okay, so we're thinking about a quantum Hall state that is gapped and that has a neutral collective mode that is gapped that corresponds to fluctuations of this nematic order parameter. So this leads us to consider the following Lagrangian. So this part is what I showed earlier, which describes the physics of the pure quantum Hall state. On top of that, we have the physics of the collective mode, the GMP mode, and then we will look at the coupling between these two theories. So this Lagrangian was given earlier. What is the Lagrangian for the dynamics of the order parameter? Well, so we can proceed in a sort of Lerner-Ginzburg fashion. So looking first at the energy density, then if we're interested near the transition, so we're assuming that we're going to have a continuous transition where this nematic order parameter will acquire an expectation value in a continuous fashion, then simply based on the symmetries and on an expansion in powers of the order parameter and its derivatives, we arrive at this simple theory. So in two dimensions, these would be the most relevant terms one could write down, and based on the symmetries, essentially these are the invariants that one would consider. So there's some phenomenological parameters. So essentially it looks very much like a phi-4 theory. And since we're looking at a quantum theory, we need to specify what is the time dynamics of this order parameter. So there's different terms we could write down. We could write down a second order Lagrangian, so a term that would look very much like this, dtqab squared, in which case the theory would be relativistic with dynamic critical exponents equal 1. Here, I will argue that it's more appropriate to consider a term which is first order in time derivatives, in which case the dynamic critical exponent would be z equal 2. So this is what I said. This is just Landau theory. Why would we write down such a term? So here we proceed by analogy with another example of quantum Hall state with a Bergen symmetry. So in the physics of the quantum Hall ferromagnet, so essentially here you consider a quantum Hall state where the state is not fully spin polarized, and you can consider the dynamics of the spin degrees of freedom. And it turns out that the dynamics of the, in that case, the ferromagnetic order parameter has a first order time derivative. And this can be traced back to the fact that the quantum Hall state breaks time reversal symmetry. So if you break time reversal symmetry, it is allowed to have a term first order in time derivatives, which is more relevant than a term that is a second order in time derivatives. So likewise here, because we have a quantum Hall state, we assume that the breaking of time reversal symmetry will be reflected in the dynamics of the order parameter. Yes?
So that, that term that's quadratic, does that include time derivatives as well?
This term here?
Yes,
no.
That's just spatial.
Correct, just spatial. So A, B, C here are spatial indices, absolutely. And the fact that this is a pneumatic order parameter, a spatial order parameter, is important because this means that the indices on the derivatives and the indices on the order parameter itself can be mixed. Whereas if you had, for example, the an internal symmetry, then you would have a dot product over the derivative and over the order parameter itself. So these would be different indices. So for example, you would have something like, you know, di or da, you know, n hat. Okay, and but so that if you expand this and something like this, you will get, in fact, more term, actually less term in this case, because symmetries can, I'm just saying here basically that this is a spatial symmetry. So when you write down this type of term, you have to be careful because both indices will transform under rotations. Yeah. Okay, so yes, so going back to this Berry phase term, generically a first order term, which is first order in time derivatives, is allowed. And there's an interesting analogy, in fact, that one can make between the ferromagnet and the pneumatic. So for a ferromagnet, essentially the order parameter is in the ferromagnetic phase is a unit vector. So if I factored out the amplitude, that lives on the three sphere, the two sphere S2. And the Berry phase, or the equivalent of this term, would be essentially it would trace out the area traced out by this order parameter on the sphere. And in the case of a pneumatic, actually it turns out that this term also has the interpretation of a Berry phase, but now the target space turns out to be non-compact. So it is the hyperbolic plane. And the point here is that this traceless symmetric matrix, essentially the constraint of tracelessness and symmetry imposes that this field lives on the two-sphere, on the hyperbolic plane. And likewise, again, this Berry phase measures the area traced out by the order parameter. And I just wanted to point out that, in fact, this term can be explicitly derived for the pneumatic transition, in this case, not in the fractional quantum Hall state, but in the Chern insulator, which essentially confirms the intuition that we had. And also, there are some other arguments by Dam Tam Son and others that derive at the same form for the Berry phase term.
Okay, the level of spin symmetry, I think, is O2, right? It's just a U1.
Yeah, so in our case, or in the ferromagnet? Yeah, in our case, we consider a spatial rotation symmetry.
Yeah, in the ferromagnet.
In the ferromagnet, it's full SU2 rotation symmetry, or SO3. Yeah, so this physics of quantum Hall ferromagnetism only occurs if basically the field is small and the G factor is very small. So you can sort of ignore the small Zeeman gap, and then the spin states are nearly degenerate. Yeah, absolutely. So it's SO3, approximate, but this description works quite well, actually. So we have the Lagrangian for the quantum Hall state for the order parameter, and now we want to couple them. So here, in the absence of explicit derivations that are available for this problem, so here we conjecture a particular form of the coupling based again on the intuition from the quantum Hall ferromagnet. So I won't spend too much time on this, but essentially, in the quantum Hall state, degrees of freedom are a current, a U1 current that is conserved. And that current can be coupled in a certain way to the pneumatic degrees of freedom. So essentially, you can construct a vector potential from these pneumatic degrees of freedom, and that vector potential can couple to this current And there's two pieces to that vector potential that have different physical interpretations, but I don't want to spend too much time on this. But essentially, the end result is this. So there's a theory that incorporates quantum Hall physics, pneumatic order, and their coupling. And interestingly, what we found was that this Lagrangian is essentially reproduces Haldane's recent description of the quantum Hall effect in terms of geometry. So Haldane uses a dynamical metric that is symmetric and unimodular, has determinant one, but actually a unimodular symmetric matrix can be written as the exponential of a traceless symmetric matrix. And if you expand for small q, essentially G can be written as the identity plus q. And essentially, if you take Haldane's geometric field theory and you substitute this expression and you expand for small q, you essentially reproduce this theory that we found. So this first result here, the take-home message of this first part of the talk is that we arrive at an interpretation of Haldane's geometric field theory as the theory of the transition between an isotropic quantum Hall state and a pneumatic quantum Hall state, where the pneumatic degrees of freedom are really intrinsic to the quantum Hall physics, and they correspond to the GMP mode, which is neutral, and that can possibly undergo a transition. So this is the goal here now, is now that we've identified that there seems to be a transition that is lurking there in the quantum Hall, fractional quantum Hall state, and can we observe it? Okay, so what would this theory predict if we were to observe that that pneumatic state? So first of all, let's look at the disordered phase, the critical point, and the ordered phase. So the isotropic phase would be the quantum Hall state that is fully gapped and rotationally invariant. Its spectrum, so it supports the usual Laughlin quasi particles and has two gap modes, one that is at very high energy, which is a cyclotron mode essentially, and there's this GMP mode. And so we conjecture that if we were to tune some parameter such that this neutral collective mode becomes gapless, because it is bosonic, it should condense, and because it carries angular momentum two, or because it is a quadrupole, then the resulting state should be a pneumatic state. So the challenge here is the following. So this is the typical energy dispersion of the GMP mode, and the minimum of this dispersion is at some finite momentum, which is roughly the inverse of the magnetic length. And so if you're familiar with superfluidity, this is very similar to the Roton minimum in superfluid helium 4. However, in superfluid helium 4, the curve bends down and there's a gapless phonon here. But because there's a magnetic field, this phonon becomes pushed to finite large energy, but this sort of Roton becomes a magnetoroton, and that is the lowest mode with the lowest energy. So usually what happens is that if you tune some parameter, typically the gap collapses at finite momentum. And because the gap collapses at finite momentum, the resulting state, the instability is towards a state that breaks the translation symmetry or becomes like a stripe phase. So this has been observed and is known. Now we want to investigate the possibility that somehow as you tune a parameter, the minimum actually shifts and becomes goes to q equals zero, and the gap eventually collapses at q equals zero. So the prediction is if this happens, because we would have a uniform order, it should be pneumatic order. Okay, that's the prediction. So that's the isotropic phase. The critical point that we predict because of this bare phase term should be a is equal to transition in the universality class of the dilute Bose gas. So I want to mention in passing that this equal to scaling for this type of transition was discussed before by Mulligan, Nayak, and Katru in an approach that is a pure gauge theory approach. So they do not have an extra pneumatic order parameter field. And furthermore, in this transition, the Laughlin quasiparticle and the Kohn mode are not involved in any essential way. They remain gapped through the transition. And finally, what would be the properties of the pneumatic phase? So there should be a gapless Goldstone mode because we break a continuous rotation symmetry. However, because this order parameter is neutral, actually, the Hall connectivity should remain quantized, even if the phase becomes compressible. And so this has been discussed theoretically by Nayak and Bonnerson, and this type of phase can be understood or called as a quasi-topological phase, where there's still a meaningful topological degeneracy, but you also have gapless mode on top of that. And interestingly, there's experiments that I will mention later as well, where this type of phenomenology is observed, where the Hall connectivity remains quantized, but there is anisotropic longitudinal transport. The optical Hall connectivity, in fact, would be affected by the pneumatic phase. So at least in the clean system and in a disordered system, it's still unclear what would happen. And so this would be a signature of the pneumaticity. And there's also pneumatic vortices now in the ordered phase. However, because we're breaking a global symmetry, then these, in fact, have logarithmically divergent energy. So one needs to go to finite temperature to observe them. And they have interesting properties. They would have a finite electric charge that is unquantized, that vanishes at the critical point. And they would also have fractional statistics. OK, so this is what this field theory that we conjecture would predict. Now, is there any reality to that? Can one see that? So to investigate that, we did a numerical study on the torus. So we're going to talk about exact diagonalization on the torus. So the model that we study is a model of interacting electrons in the lowest lambda level at filling 1/3. And so the Hamiltonian looks like this. So there is a potential, and we have interacting densities. So the kinetic energy, in fact, has been projected out. So we're looking at a Hamiltonian projected onto the lowest lambda level. And generically, Haldane introduced an expansion of a generic interaction potential in terms of what are known as Haldane pseudopotentials. So realistic interactions, for example, the Coulomb interaction has a certain set of pseudopotentials. In the case of interacting fermions, only odd integers appear, and typically V1 is the largest pseudopotential, and then we have a decreasing sequence of odd pseudopotentials. Interestingly, for a model with only V1 has an exact ground state, which is the Laughlin state. So the model we will be studying here is a very simple model. So we will consider a model with V1 and V3. So we will consider essentially V3 over V1 as a coupling constant that will vary. So for generic V3, there's no exact ground state for this system. So we can only do a numerical study. Okay, so this is the spectrum of a typical spectrum that you find. So this different colors correspond to a different number of particles. Once again, this is a theory on the torus. K is the momentum quantum number, E is the energy, and this is a typical spectrum. So the lowest mode is this GMP mode that has a minimum at some finite wave vector. And this is for V1 equals 1. So this would be the spectrum, essentially, of the ground state here corresponds to the Laughlin state, and here we have excited states. Okay, so just a little bit of terminology here. So in the plots that I will be showing, I will plot both the direct gap and the indirect gap. So the direct gap will be the gap at Q equals 0, and whenever the gap here, indirect gap will be a gap that occurs at a finite value of momentum. Okay. So here I will just show a little movie to illustrate what happens. So this is a simulation for 10 particles. This number of flux quanta tells you what the filling is, which is 1/3. And here I will plot the spectrum for varying V3 over V1. Okay. So essentially what will happen, it will be hard to see perhaps in this plot, there will be other plots later, but what will happen is that initially the minimum of the dispersion is at finite momentum, but actually as you increase V3 over V1, the gap, the minimum eventually goes to k equals 0, and actually the gap collapses at k equals 0, which is the scenario we wanted. So if I play this little video, so the spectrum goes down initially, the minimum is here, but you see this state that goes down and actually eventually wins. And after the gap closing, the lowest state besides the ground state is still at k equals zero, and then the spectrum goes up. Okay, so this is what happens. To see it a little bit better, this is the type of spectra you get. So here, I plot the again the direct gap, which is the k equals zero gap, and the indirect gap, which is a finite k gap, as a function of this tuning parameter of v3 over v1. And as you can see, although the indirect gap is the smallest one at the beginning, eventually the direct gap wins and closes before the indirect gap. So for 9 electrons, it's still quite rounded, but as you increase the number of particles, you can see that there's a sharp transition and the gap closes always in the zero momentum sector. So the blue curve is the direct gap, and so there's a gap.
So you're sure the indirect gap cannot close as increasing number of particles?
What's that?
Are you sure the indirect gap cannot close as increasing number of particles?
Which gap?
The indirect.
Oh, the red one? Yeah, so this is what happened, right? So this is 9, 10, 12, 13. We cannot go much higher than that. That's basically the most we can do. And so you're concerned that maybe this gap will close as well. That's all we can say. I mean, this is the data now, so it's possible. I don't know if we have. Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you do a finite size too?
Finite size, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we only have 4 points. So it's, I mean, we can simulate less than that, but that's
sure, that's not meaningful.
Do I have this plot here? The indirect gap. Let's see.
I guess it does.
No.
Huh? Doesn't look like it's closing.
Yeah, it looks fairly. Here it's like, it's a little bigger than here. I think it's like 0.05. Well, yeah, it's hard to tell. I mean, it's a good
question. It seems going down a bit, but.
I mean, yeah, it's a good question.
To what extent do you trust ED when you approach critical point anyways when you have
of course.
10 particles?
Yeah, but so let me show you other data.
Also,
yeah.
So the blue curve touches the x axis in the last.
Here? Yeah, we don't know. So there seems to be a little bit of an odd effect. So here I didn't show the n equal 11, so for n equal 11, well, n equal 9, you can't really see, but this also occurs for n equal 11. So there seems to be like an even odd effect that there's sort of two gap closings for odd number of particles. We don't understand that. There could be some. Could be two phase transitions eventually, or one of them just disappeared when you go large system size. Yes.
So these are numerical simulations. Right?
Yes.
You're trying to verify the validity of that of the model that you showed before that program. So what about experimental?
Yes. I will come back to that in the towards the end of the talk.
Okay.
Yes. So keep your question. So that's what we're doing. So essentially, the beginning of the talk is a little bit of motivation, but in a sense, now we're kind of interested in what is going on here in some ways. What is happening? Okay, so this is just to summarize what I said. It seems that according to this data, the gap closing eventually occurs at zero momentum, which would be the scenario that we wanted to happen. Okay, so how can we try to extract some physics from this data? So based on our earlier intuition, we're guessing that perhaps this is a pneumatic phase. So how can we try to test that hypothesis? So first, as Will mentioned, we have significant finite size effects. So any kind of finite size scaling is sort of meaningless to do. So how can we try to extract the physics? So one thing we can do is, if we assume that this is a pneumatic, then there should be the dependence of these energy gaps on the aspect ratio. Okay, so the idea is that So because we're looking at a torus, in fact, the geometry that we're studying explicitly breaks the SO2 rotational invariance. So if we were studying things on a disk, it would be different, but here we have a torus. So actually, we're really not looking at an O2 pneumatic, but actually an IZ pneumatic. So we have a C4 symmetry that will be broken spontaneously. So you can think that your pneumatic user freedom would either align along one or the other side of the torus. And if the torus is isotropic, if the aspect ratio is 1 between the lengths in both directions, then these two ground states should be degenerate. But if I stretch the torus, for example, then the pneumatic degree of freedom might want to align themselves preferably with one direction rather than the other. So to test that hypothesis, we can try to ask what would be the effect on the spectrum of changing the aspect ratio of the torus. Because before doing a numerical simulation, we can try to ask from the field theory what would be the prediction. So the field theory we had earlier was essentially the 5-4 theory for the bosonic QAB. And so if you look at a phase transition in a finite size system, then you need to consider the following two effects. So I mentioned the fact that the aspect ratio should act somehow as a Zeeman field for these two states. So I denote these states by some kind of pseudospin up and down, and the aspect ratio should give a splitting between these two states. However, because we're in a finite size system, you can actually tunnel from one ground state to the other. Of course, the energy cost for that, or the action for that, would be exponentially suppressed in the system size. But because the systems are finite, then there's a finite probability amplitude. So you can do a calculation for that. And effectively, this gives you an effective Hamiltonian for the quasi-degenerate subspace of ground states. Okay, so there's two terms. There's a tau z term, essentially, that gives me a linear splitting between these two. So if you do the calculation, you find that the splitting effectively at small deviations from aspect ratio 1 is linear in the aspect ratio change, and it's power law in the volume, whereas this tunnel term, which is tau x term in this language, is exponentially suppressive. You can do essentially a double PV calculation or an instant tunnel calculation. Find that, and as I said, it's exponentially suppressed in the system size, and also depends on the magnitude of your parameter. But essentially, you expect that kind of finite size splitting of the two Bose states in the spectrum. So if you diagonalize this Hamiltonian, it's a little bit like a Dirac Hamiltonian, and the splitting goes like this. There's a sort of constant piece that is exponential in the volume, and there's a piece that goes like delta squared or small delta. So now let's see what the numerics gives us. So first of all, if we try to change the aspect ratio in the isotropic phase, so this would be in the Laplace state, V1 equals 1, no V3, 12 particles, then you can see that the spectrum essentially doesn't care about the aspect ratio. It varies very little, which is consistent with an isotropic state that does not care about the geometry. Now, if we go into the pneumatic phase, so the gap, to go back, what gap am I talking about? The gap is essentially, The gap will be the gap, so here is a gap, so essentially there will be a state here, it's your energy, you can normalize things, and there's the first excited state here. So I'm talking about, when I talk about two states, I talk about the zero energy state, and this first excited state, which I want to interpret as the quasi-degenerate ground state. Okay, so this is what you observe if you go to the pneumatic phase. So for small aspect ratio, there's a splitting that is very close to linear, and there's a small upturn here that can interpret possibly as essentially this small number here. So remember that this is exponentially suppressed in the system size. So we expect this to be a pretty small number, and here, so essentially, delta is very small, then this curve should be roughly linear. So that seems to be consistent with that. Okay, so this is a large V3 where we want to pass it. All right. This is one thing we can do. Another thing we can do is a variational calculation. Okay. Yes. So the idea here is that we could try to see if we can do the analog of mean field calculation for this transition. Okay, so to do that, we need some variational states. So as part of a series of papers written by all the Hamiltonian operators, they constructed a family of anisotropy Laplacian states. Basically, the idea is that you can, so Haldane essentially observed that an essential rotational symmetry is not essential to the quantum Hall state. After all, this is a topological phase of matter, does not care about geometry, so one should be able to write a class of Laplacian states that have the same topological order as the regular Laplacian state, but that do not have rotational symmetry. And so we essentially constructed a wave function that is parametrized by this new modular metric. And for example, you can compute things using these wave functions. This is an example of sort of the shape of the quantum Hall droplets. And you can see that. So this would be the droplet for the isotropic quantum Hall state. So if G was the Carnot delta. And this is for a deformed Laplacian state where G is some non-trivial value of would not be the identity matrix in the droplet, the density profile would be non-adaptive like this. Okay, so there's essentially two continuous parameters that parameterize this metric, which are essentially Q and phi, which are the amplitude and the order of the amplitude and the phase or the angle of the pneumatic order parameter. So this is an explicit connection between Haldane's description and ours. And so these wave functions are known. One can do calculations with them. And so the idea here is to compute a variational energy using the variational principle of quantum mechanics. So we take our Hamiltonian that has B1 plus B3, and we compute the expectation value of this Hamiltonian in this standard wave functions divided by the norm squared of the wave function. And we try to see does this energy, what is the minimum? So is this energy minimized by non-zero values of Q and phi or not? So because the Hamiltonian itself is rotationally inert, this energy in fact does not depend on phi at all. So it is a function of the amplitude itself. So you can do this calculation numerically and minimize Q to see what is the minimum value of Q. And in fact, what we find is this. So it's plotted a little bit backwards for technical reasons, but essentially this is the value of Q that minimizes the energy. So for small values of H over B1, the energy is minimized by Q equals zero, so by a isotropic state. But we find that actually for some value of H over B1, in fact, the order parameter is non-zero. Okay. So because this is a variational calculation, there's very little, there's no fluctuation effects. So we don't expect much dependence on the system size. But if you look at the critical coupling here, it's fairly close to what is seen numerically, taking into account, again, the fact that we have very small systems and this is a variational calculation. Okay, so in ED, we see a gap closing that varies between 0.47 and 0.88, depending on system size. And here we have something that is close to 0.6. So it's not completely on.
So is this a disk?
This calculation, this is on the torus actually. You can write down these way, you can construct these wave functions on the torus as well, not only on the disk. Yeah. So in fact this was done numerically, but you could try to do this calculation on the disk. So there's one of these papers has the formulation on the disk. The problem is how do you go about calculating this? So there's ways you could you could do this in the thermodynamic limit in principle, because there are expressions for these wave functions on the plane or on the disk with z essentially. The question is how do you compute this overlap? So it's a little bit like a plasma analogy calculation, but it's hard. So there's a way to do this in momentum space, and you could do some expansion in small q. So that's something that we may want to look at, but it's hard to do. But the fact that there's not much, I mean, this is only for three systems size close to each other, but the fact that there's not a whole lot of variation here I don't think that the analytical result would be drastically different than that. But that's another thing. Okay. All right. Okay, so a last test or way of looking at physics that we can do is to try to compute some kind of pneumatic susceptibility. Okay, so you know that if there's a phase transition, then phase transition should be reflected in some kind of peak in the susceptibility associated with that order parameter. Okay, so if it's a first order transition, it's a jump. If it's a continuous transition, it's a divergence, but there should be some symmetry. So if we believe this field theory, then the pneumatic susceptibility, so the static susceptibility, the thermodynamic susceptibility, should go, you know, essentially that order R, where R is this tuning parameter here. So you have a couple, you know, deviation from the critical coupling, which is V3 over V1 in this problem. So this thing blows up when you're close to the transition. Okay, so let's say we would like to compute this in our model. Because we have a microscopic model and this is a field theory, we don't know how to explicitly construct this Q in terms of the microscopic degrees of freedom, but can we construct nevertheless some kind of pneumatic order parameter, something that transforms like a pneumatic order parameter in terms of the electronic degrees of freedom? And the answer is yes. So what can we do? So let's consider this function. Okay, so this function is defined as the ground state expectation value of the product of two densities, two density operators, many body density operators have different ones, essentially split by some vector d, whose magnitude is fixed. So this is just something that I construct. Okay? So I'm going to pick a vector d whose magnitude is some microscopic length. The natural choice here is the magnetic length. Everything is measured in units of the magnetic length. So this is, you know, a quasi-local, essentially a local thing. It just measures what happens around point R. Okay? And I consider theta, the angle here, to be a variable. So this function depends essentially on this angle theta. Now, what's the properties of this function d? So if we are in a translationally invariant state, then this function does not depend on R. It only depends on the relative difference between these two coordinates, which is d. Now, if these densities were the microscopic densities and unprojected densities, then they would be density operators in units at different points, and so this function would be symmetric under d equals to minus d. Now, in this problem, we're looking at, it's more useful to work with projected densities, so densities that are projected to the lowest lambda level, and these do not commute, so they satisfy some special algebra known as the GMP algebra. But actually, you can show that the part of this, so you can break this into a commutator plus an anti-commutator, and the part that depends on the commutator actually vanishes exactly. So turns out that in fact this function is also symmetric for the projected densities. So essentially, you have a function that is insensitive to a flip of this vector d. So as far as this function is concerned, this d is a headless vector. So it has the right transformation properties that we want for a pneumatic order parameter. And furthermore, if the ground state here is isotropic, then this function must vanish, because it cannot have any dependence on the angle theta. Okay, this is just what I just said. So essentially, this f will be taken as our definition of the pneumatic order parameter. How can we make this a little more explicit? Well, this is a function of an angle, theta, so we can expand it. We can do multiple expansion in powers of angular momentum, essentially. And because this function is even under d goes to minus d, only the even angular momenta show up. And if you keep the only the L equal 1 term in this expansion, then this, in fact, can be taken as a definition of the pneumatic order. That's a real and imaginary component, and they transform in the appropriate way under rotations of theta due to this factor of 2 here. Just wanted to mention that this is similar to, there's similar order parameters. I guess I won't go too fast here. All right, okay, so before I mention that, So this could be computed. So numerically, we could go with our numerics. We have the exact Rossi wave function. We know how to write down these operators. We can compute this expectation value. And then we would have to do an integral over all angles. But instead of doing that, we can just look at a more simpler quantity, which is basically like a D wave factor order number. So that would be what you look at if you were actually, if you're looking at the breaking of C4, which is what we're doing because we're on a torus. So really, you can look at the difference between this function at theta equals 0, so along the x-axis, minus this function along the y-axis. And this would clearly measure the breaking of C4 rotation symmetry. In terms of these angular momentum components, it is an infinite sum of angular momentum components. So strictly speaking, in terms of continuous rotation symmetry, it is a sum of thematic and higher attic order parameters, but still a valid measure of the breaking of rotational invariance. And so if we actually go back to the definition of these operators in right rotating momentum space, then this is what this function looks like. And if you look at literature, this looks a lot like your parameter used to study pneumatic transition in different systems, but it clearly measures the right. Okay. So this is a pneumatic accessibility. If we were to compute this directly using our ED results, because we have a finite size system, there's no breaking of rotation symmetry. So you cannot, you will always get zero, of course. But what you can do is you can add a small breaking, symmetry breaking field and measure the response and then divide by that field. So essentially, you do a limit response. So we have our aspect ratio, this is our symmetry breaking field. So for small breakings of rotational symmetry, we expect that this order parameter will scale linearly and can extract a linear coefficient, which is an pneumatic system. Now if we look at what we get, so this is what we get. So for different system sizes, the curve looks different, but in all cases there is a clear peak. Could be a jump here, it's unclear, but clearly there's some kind of divergence at a special point, and if you put the gap closing down on top, then it clearly occurs where the gap closes. Okay, so there's some more complicated features here. So again, this is the n equal 11 data. So again, the even odd effect here, there seems to be a second gap closing. Unclear what is going on here, but in all cases, there's certainly something going on at this gap closing point. Okay. All right, so now, what does this mean for experiments? So going back to your question. So I briefly mentioned some experiments. 3 years ago, there was a very interesting paper in the group of Jim Eisenstein and Jim Shia, collaborators. So they observed anisotropy transport in the 7/3 state. So this is the third filling of the second Reynolds level. So I won't go into the data too much, but essentially, they're looking at applying a tilted field to a Von Hall sample. So at zero tilted field, there's a slight anisotropy that they don't make a big deal out of. It seems to occur for various field fractions. They say that it's presumably related to the apparatus. But as they increase the tilted field, there's a very large resistance anisotropy that shows up. It's complicated data that increases first and goes down after some large anisotropies. There's a complicated temperature dependence as well. All of this is quite mysterious and certainly still under unclear what to make of this, but certainly very interesting data. But there is clearly some anisotropy that shows up in the system. And what I did not mention here, I don't have the plots, but it turns out that the Hall connectivity is still quantized to basically 7/3 square range. Okay, so it's a one Hall state, as I said, quantized Hall state, but the von Schumann transport is anisotropy. So first of all, in all these experiments, there is a tilted field. So really, the symmetry, if anything, is clearly broken explicitly. Okay, pick a specific axis, and then you introduce some axis in the plane, so you break the rotation symmetry explicitly. It turns out that, so that's the first statement. So there's some recent work by Zlatko Papic showing that studying this system, so really 7/3 in the quorum walls with some parabolic confinement potential with full interaction and a tilted field. And this study shows that there's a good overlap of the ground state with these anisotropic Laplacian state that I mentioned earlier, that I used as variation wave functions, for tilt angles that are not too large. So if the tilt angle becomes too large, in case of numerics, the overlap becomes very bad, and presumably it would some kind of strike state possibly. Okay. So what to make of this? So clearly, as I said, the rotation symmetry is explicitly broken, but the anisotropy is quite large. So it could be that although the system is still in an isotropic phase, the system could have a large magnetic susceptibility due to a proximity to a transition to a magnetic state. So that's really a possibility. So to kind of explore this, what we did is a simpler study than done here, but we studied the variant of our model. So we looked at the Coulomb potential plus a small tuning parameter V3 in both the lowest lambda level, which I've studied so far, and in the second lambda level. So this is the results. So in the lowest lambda level at 1/3, the data is very similar to what I showed previously. So there's a gap closing transition, and then gap goes up again. The only difference with the V1, V3 model is that this critical coupling here is smaller. And that's just because the Coulomb potential already has some V3 in it. So it's as if you started from the V1, V3 model, but with a V3 that is already sizable. So you reach the gap closing point a little bit earlier. But you're still, the pure Coulomb problem, if you will, is still below the transition. But things are very different at 7/3, which is the currently studied fraction. So if you do this calculation, in a sense, it seems that this Coulomb potential, which is the one that exists in nature, of course, is very close to a critical point. So if you think of this as a critical point, then the internal system would be quite close to that critical point, according to this calculation. Okay? So likewise, we can do a computation of the susceptibility. So physics that you would expect. So once again, the susceptibility peaks close to the critical point, which is closer than before. In the second lambda level, the susceptibility is quite large for the pure Coulomb potential. So that simple calculation, of course, is certainly not, does not account for all of the experimental factors, but the simplified model would suggest that the experimental system may not be in a pneumatic phase, but could be proximate to a transition and would have a large pneumatic susceptibility. So this is it. So this is my summary. So what I presented is some numerical evidence for a transition in a from an isotropic fractional Coulomb Hall state to a pneumatic fractional Coulomb Hall state. So we're looking at a transition between a topological phase to a broken symmetry, a phase where topological order coexists with broken symmetry in a relatively simple model, only V1 and V3, using different methods. I just wanted to point out that this is different from a number of recent studies where these anisotropic Laplacian state have been used extensively, where the breaking of rotational symmetry is always explicit. So either by introducing a tilted field, as in the work by Papic, or by introducing some anisotropy at the level of the effective mass in the kinetic energy, or at the level of the dielectric constant. So imagine a crystalline environment where there's some anisotropy that is reflected in the dielectric properties of the material. So in our case, rotational symmetry, the Hamiltonian is always a different variant. So symmetry breaking is spontaneous. And so this, the fact that the gap at the transition closes at zero momentum suggests that our earlier interpretation would be realized here. And finally, as far as the permits are concerned, our results suggest that the parallel system might be close to this transition, so we have a large susceptibility, which could explain possibly the large anisotropy in the resistance for the Machin transport. Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
So can you explain a bit the physics of the V3 potential? I think I missed it.
Yeah.
What exactly is
the form of the interaction? Yeah, that's a good question. So there's different ways of seeing this, whether you're in the momentum space or in real space. Where did I put this? So this is the form of the interaction. So the Coulomb interaction would be 1 over q squared or 1 over q, something like that. And then you could expand it in a basis of orthogonal functions. Here, these are Laguerre polynomials. You could always do that if you wanted. Now, why is this an interesting expansion? So it turns out that if you take only V1, this Hamiltonian has the Laughlin state as an exact ground state. Okay, so this is a very useful statement because this was one of the first examples of an exact isolable strongly correlated model that gives you topological ordered states exactly. So in momentum space L1, I think that this is just a constant, if I'm not mistaken. Forgetting now, I think it is just a constant. In real space, if you expand this out, then it is a derivative of delta functions. So it's basically a very ultra-short range potential. So it's a derivative of a delta function interaction between particles. The V3 has an extra power of momentum. So these are orthogonal polynomials. So I think the V3 here would have maybe it's q squared, or maybe it's cubic power q squared, I'm not sure. But it's some polynomial in q, which translates into higher derivatives. So it would be something like a third derivative of delta functions. So it's increasingly short-range potentials. And that's right, so there's, so these are, on the sphere, they're often known as the called into potentials or in momentum space. In real space, they're sometimes known as the Truman-Kittleson potential. And it's basically something like, so if I sum over all the particles in first quantization, then it would be something like, there's a power of gradients. It would be something like that. So it's a higher, M1, and then interaction potential. So something like that. Some short range potential. So the V1 only model is exactly solvable. Depending on the total fraction, you can generate Laughlin states for all, this is for 1/3, you can generate them for all the odd denominator fractions. But if you have V1 and V3 at filling factor 1/3, the exact state, the ground state is not there. You don't even know the state. Or the other way to put it, V3 only. For infinite V3 over V1, we don't know the ground state.
So is it clear that V3 would encourage domesticity in this case versus other super-breaking phases like spikes or?
Well, I don't know, we've only looked at one order.
But I'm just like heuristically, before doing any numerics, what do you expect with?
The only intuition we have is that V3 seems to close the gap of the GMP mode, which is a quantum polar mode, which there's independent results that indicate, it's not a proof, but there's independent results that indicate that the GMP mode has a symmetry of the pneumatic mode. So V3 lowering that gap seems to do that. Now, if you're asking sort of microscopically, why is it that, it's a good question. I mean, these anisotropic Laughlin states, if you think about, so the Laughlin states are, the isotropic Laughlin states, essentially, you know the wave function, right? It's product of I less than j, z I minus z j, the third power, or 1/3 state. So it has cubic zeros, order 3 zeros, where two particles come together. These anisotropic states will split these cubic zeros. So you will have something like Zi minus Zj minus 2 Z0, where this is some fixed number, depending on the amplitude of the parameter. I think maybe it's not exactly that, but it's close to that. So it splits the zeros. So if you can somehow think that it repels or, I mean, we don't have a real space computation, but maybe that's something that we can be thought about. So that's a good question.
Is that, I was wondering, what's the motivation for stopping at, say, a five or four kind of theory? Why not go to infinite order?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So in a sense, where if I go here, one of the motivations is just sort of standard field theory where we're looking at, we're interested in the vicinity of the critical point. So we're assuming, there's some assumptions here. So we're assuming that the transition is continuous, which means that if you were to look at how the order parameter goes as a function of, so this is our coupling constant, which was V3 over V1. So if you were to plot, you know, the expectation value of this order parameter, essentially, you know, we assume that it's something like this. So it's continuous. So there's a critical value. It's zero in the isotropic phase. It's not zero in the pneumatic phase. And if you're interested in doing a field theory, you would look at close to the critical point, and Q is small, close to that critical point. So in that sense, Q is a small number. So higher powers of Q are increasingly small. So that's why you would not keep that number. If you're interested in describing the physics deep in the pneumatic phase, absolutely, you're right that you would need infinite number order terms, powers of Q. So that theory breaks down if you go deep in the phase. And finally, in the expansion of derivatives, we're looking at a long wavelength. Assume that things are, that's why we can use field theory. So continuum that goes back to the arguments at the beginning. So in that sense, we're doing a sort of expansion in powers of field and its derivatives. From the RG's point of view, you could say that nearer transition, higher order terms are irrelevant. So you can drop them.
So it doesn't have anything to do with renormalizability?
Well, yes, that's right. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so the higher order terms
should be non-renormalizable.
Non-renormalizable, absolutely. So if you want a renormalizable theory, that's right. In fact, this theory at z equal 2 is exactly marginal. Well, it's marginal. There's logarithmic corrections.
Is it irrelevant? Like marginally irrelevant?
It is marginally irrelevant. Yes, that's right. So in fact, this was studied by the papers I know are papers by Prokofiev and Sistrunov and these guys.
So no, but just doing field theory, I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. If you look at the scaling of these things, this is what you would keep. This term is marginal, and this the interaction. This is all three fields.
Because you can do a full expansion on this one.
Yeah, and in DPL 2, it is marginally irrelevant. So it's three bullets of Gaussian theory. The critical exponent is 1/2, but correlation functions have logarithmic corrections. So this is, in fact, it's like five-order theory in four dimensions, but because this is a first-order time derivative, it's not relativistic. Actually, it's marginal in two dimensions. Changes the scaling dimensions of the fields. So yeah, that's really
interesting.
Yes.
How about the gravitational transcendence term for the GAE? Do you think it's possible or?
Yeah, it's a great question. So one thing I didn't mention here, this term in fact is, if you write down the Wenzi term, okay, so the Wenzi term, is a term that mixes metric degrees of freedom and phase field. So it would be something like, so you would introduce a field which is a spin connection, which depends on the metric, and then you would have a phase field here. Something like that. So there's, right, to expand this, the components will have omega zero and then parallel bay and then other terms. So this term, in fact, if you expand this term, it will be precisely this very phase term. Okay? And in this term, if you look at the composite boson picture can replace this term. Yes, in fact, I should really write in my language, this is this field. So this basically has background field as its expectation value, no, such that you basically get B omega zero. And again, if you expand this, if you expand omega in part of Q, you really get B times q, epsilon q, dq. Okay. And b is related to the density. So I didn't tell you what this lambda was. But it turns out that if you want to reproduce the correct result for the viscosity, or alternatively, if you want this to be the correct, you know, the shift on the sphere, or whatever you want to call it, then the fact that the density is equal to, you know, field divided by, I don't want to write wrong things, but it's proportional to that. And this is proportional to the filling factor. So there's a quantized number in front. And so yeah, so the short answer is this term is basically the temporal part of the Wang's lambda. The other part comes from this part. I didn't mention that very much, but this term, in our formulation, things are not generally covariant, so the coefficients will not be the same. But if you want to match Lemkin's theory exactly, then you need to impose a constraint between coefficients. But physics is very similar. Yeah, that's right. So if you were to suppose that this field response, that the internal metrics is tied to the metric of the space that the system is on, then you would essentially get that kind of response.
So the experiment, can you rule out stripes, or is it?
Could
that cause also some similar signatures versus simplicity?
Yeah, I don't know much about stripes, so I'm not sure. So in the stripe phase, I do not know if the Hall connectivity is quantized in the stripe phase. I don't think it is. I don't think it's a quantum Hall state. I remember correctly, but correct me if I'm wrong. So my understanding was that this, it's really this result was quite striking because the observation of, so anisotropic quantum Hall states or anisotropic states in the high-magnetic fields, you know, in the lowest lambda level and higher lambda levels have been studied for a long time. So in the 90s, for example, there was work showing that, certainly the higher lambda, you know, but all these states would have an unquantized Hall connectivity. So that's sort of the new physics here.
In this case, it stays quantized to the same accuracy as the non-tilted field.
Until you reach some. Yeah, it's too bad I didn't put the data up on the slides for the Hall connectivity. So I encourage you to go look at the paper if you're interested. But from my recollection, the Hall connectivity is really very accurately quantized in that state. They also have results for the 5-half, where the physics is a little bit different. It's kind of weird. It's even weirder there. I think you recover. Here it looks a little bit like this. It never happened, but you recover isotropic transport at large tilted fields. So where those are, the tilted field is actually anisotropic, but transport becomes anisotropic again. This is kind of re-entrant anisotropy, so it's a bit stranger. So this data is very interesting. I mean, there's lots of unexplained physics. Temperature dependent, talk at all about temperature dependence, so we're still trying to understand. So there's two different results. We have a theoretical result, which I think is interesting in its own right. The question whether it's directly relevant to this or not is a wholly different question. But so a lot of those results seem to suggest that up to a certain anisotropy, this is just you break the symmetry explicitly, so the system becomes anisotropic. In a sense, that's not surprising, but this is your temperature statement. I have to explain this, I don't know, this is quite puzzling. So there should be lots of room for theoretical statistics.
What happens in the one-third?
The actual one-third?
Yeah.
The tilted field, I do not know, but I don't think there's anything as striking as this. I assume there's some anisotropy, but I'm not aware. My knowledge is that all the sort of interesting results concerning anisotropic physics in lambda levels is at higher lambda levels. So it could also be that,
Because your theory doesn't care about this, right?
No, it does.
It does.
It does. Well, it does in a sense because the superpotentials are quite different. So. So if you look at it, this is why
the numerics was for the one-third.
No, yeah, the first part, but then we did 1/3 and 7/3. That second part was just to illustrate that. So the first part was just a sort of the toy model to see that this thematic transition can occur in principle in the toy model. This is a model that is closer to experiment in the sense that we use the Coulomb interaction, which, yeah, so I didn't emphasize it, the Coulomb interaction has all the supertemporal, V1, V3, V5, with some pace, the decreasing some power law action. So at 1/3 you would be this, so the experiment would be here. So that would be, you know, the 1/3 quantum Hall state that you see in the experiment. It's gas, it's isotropic, still the transition would be normal. At 7/3, things are different, the pseudo potentials are different. That's when you projected it. Because you do projections, so the bare potential is the same, but the projected potential is different. And at 7/3, from that point of view, the system is close to being compressible. It could be isotropic, but close to the transition. So that's really what we're suggesting here. But this numerics, okay, has a cool interaction, which is the real interaction, but it does not have the confining potential. So, okay, if you unlock this more accurately,
but the field theory doesn't care about it.
The field theory.
So it's
not
really in states numerically.
The field theory, because it's a field theory, you know, it has denominable parameters that you have to. So presumably these parameters would depend on the film fraction. So I would say, you know, if I really wanted to fit the parameters of my field theory to the numerics, I would go and, you know, for example, when I did this finite size study here. So I had parameters, I had constants. So if I really wanted to know what the parameters are, I would go try to fit this to the numeric, extract alpha, delta, etc. And these would really be different for first order, second order level. I mean, the critical coupling is different, so it clearly means that the parameters in field theory are different. Because we're projecting to a different sector of coupling. Yeah, so field theory is only valid for a specific film fraction. Well, valid. It's meant to be described only specified.
Any other question? No question, yes, I'm Joseph.